The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slotkey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2018 issue of Discover Magazine. First up, we have the article, A Mindset for Mars. Space agencies are still figuring out the best personalities for a trek to the Red Planet. Can we go to Mars without going crazy? In May 2001, Discover's cover story asked exactly that, exploring unanswered questions about the psychological perils of humans crammed together and flung through space. At the time, scientists didn't have much data to predict how people would handle the six-month journey. Researchers realized interpersonal skills and camaraderie would be critical to success. We're still not sure how things would go, but growing interest in the mental risks of space travel, which NASA lists as one of the biggest threats to astronauts, has spawned a new wave of research and technology. Experts are developing stress management systems, including virtual reality programs and robotic companions to help interplanetary travelers cope on their trip. And projects that simulate long-term space travel are giving researchers insights into how we'll deal. Participants endure months in cramped confines in analog missions at NASA's facilities in Houston, as well as remote places like Antarctica, the floor of the Atlantic Ocean, and atop a Hawaiian volcano. The European Space Agency's CAVES program, started in 2011, sends participants into unmapped Italian caverns to test and train their cooperative exploration skills. Then there's the final run of Mars 500, another international Martian analog, where six men from four countries simulated an entire mission to the Red Planet over 17 months, from 2010 to 2011, in a tiny Moscow facility, the closest we've gotten to the real thing. Those projects suggest space agencies are taking the psychology of astronauts more seriously than it did in 2001, says David Dinges, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Good thing, too, since Dinges, who was featured in our 2001 article, and colleagues published a study in 2014 reporting two Mars 500 crew members accounted for 85% of the mission's reported conflicts. Clearly, selecting voyagers with the right psychological profile is critical to mission success. Though we still don't know what that profile looks like, it's becoming easier to see what won't work. Having six type A personalities on a long, boring voyage may not be the best combination, says psychologist Gary Strangeman, who works with the Translational Research Institute for Space Health, a collaboration between NASA and a consortium led by the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Jack Stuster, a cultural anthropologist who has studied journals kept by both astronauts and Earthbound explorers, says behavioral issues are a surmountable challenge. Enthusiasm for putting the first footprints on Mars, he thinks, will inspire resilience. Humans will endure almost anything to be among the first. Our next article is Knock on Wood, Why We Latch On to Superstitious Behaviors and How to Give Them Up. Last March, it snowed. And snowed. And snowed. It was so heavy that roofs around my town were caving in, trapping pets and trucks and leaving people homeless. My own roof had several feet piled on. One night, flakes perpetually pelting down, I couldn't sleep. I listened for the creaks of soon-to-collapse timbers. I imagined the porch overhang ripping away from the kitchen. I stared into the dark. Did I eventually haul myself out of bed to shovel the roof? No, my fear of falling from such a height was too great, as was my love of a warm bed. Instead, I knocked on wood, repeatedly. My bedside table is wood, and my knuckles wrapped it with each new terrifying thought. A wooden necklace hangs at the head of my bed. I tap that too. This wasn't a one-time snowstorm of the century deal. No matter the season or situation, knocking on wood is how I ward off the dangers of life. I'm not alone. Superstitions and magical thinking aren't really special, says Jane Risen, a professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago. They're just part of the way we think about things. Don't open an umbrella indoors. Avoid black cats. Be wary of Friday the 13th. Superstitions like these abound. In 2015, a poll by 60 Minutes and Vanity Fair found that 60% of respondents admitted to knocking on wood. These beliefs begin in childhood. Kids have to learn about these things first, says Jacqueline Woolley, a professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Austin and an expert on childhood superstitions. They're picking up the superstitions of their particular culture. But soon after this childhood belief peaks, it starts falling. Take the concept of luck. By age 4, children are starting to hear about it. A couple of years later, they believe in it pretty strongly. But then the skepticism kicks in pretty quickly after that, says Woolley. She and her team witnessed this transition during a study published in 2017 in the Psychonomic Bulletin and Review. When told an improbable story, for example, one in which a severely injured dog heals without medical care, most children tried to find a natural explanation. But 5- and 6-year-olds also often credited miracles or luck. These supernatural explanations started to drop with 7- to 8-year-olds, and 9-year-olds were much more likely to say that events were caused by skill or effort, not luck. I can't remember when my knocking on wood habit kicked in. I do, however, remember avoiding stepping on sidewalk cracks, or I'd break my mother's back. I also remembered that habit quickly dying, since it was impractical and simply hadn't been proven true. Despite this childhood rise and fall in superstitious beliefs, some persist into adulthood, even for people like me who don't truly believe. Will knocking on wood really save my roof? No, yet I do it anyway. In a study published in 2008 in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, Risen found that participants believed it was bad luck to tempt fate, even when they didn't believe in fate. She further examined this contradiction in a 2016 study published in the Psychological Review. We see people maintaining these beliefs that they themselves acknowledge are irrational, she tells me. They'll say, I know it's crazy, but I'm going to do this. We have these beliefs because they're the output of pretty basic cognitive processes. We have two ways of thinking, she explains. One is intuitive, fast, efficient, and quick to jump to conclusions. This can provide a seeming rationale for those crazy beliefs. Did my roof collapse? No. Therefore, my knocking on wood must have been effective. I'll do it again next time. Then we have a slower, more deliberate way of thinking. It may jump in to point out my faulty reasoning and recognize that my knocking has nothing to do with whether or not the roof caves in. But Risen says, detecting an error in your intuitive belief doesn't necessarily lead to you correcting it. It seems that some intuitions are just very difficult to shake. People also like to feel a sense of control. I may not have been shoveling on the roof, but at least I was doing something. And it may have given me enough peace of mind to allow me to eventually sleep. These beliefs and behaviors actually do end up regulating your emotions, says Risen. When you knock on wood, you may worry about this less. And it never hurts to hedge your bets, usually. Woolley provides her own example of owning a parking angel that once hung from her rearview mirror. If she were alone and desperate for parking, she might rub the angel and recite its attached poem. But if she had company in the car, I might look like a fool, so I'm not going to do it, she says. Woolley explains that once a superstition is established, we do a cost-benefit analysis that can make it seem like not performing the ritual poses a risk. Skipping it can even give some people anxiety. So if no one is around to think the superstitious ritual is crazy and add a cost to performing it, we are more likely to complete it out of a better safe than sorry mindset, indicating that we must believe in it at least a little bit. I also wonder if parenthood has anything to do with the strength of my beliefs. I don't only knock on wood to save my roof, but to save my children. Is my son at a party? Please bring him home safe. Is my daughter on a road trip? Please keep the roads clear. And while my kids have never been gravely ill, knock on wood, superstitions have helped other parents in that terrifying situation. During a 2017 study in the neonatal unit at Santa Lucia General University Hospital in Cartagena, Spain, researchers discovered that about 40% of parents said they believed in magical concepts like the evil eye and protective amulets that were placed by more than 26% of the children. So, am I relegated to this superstitious life forever? No, according to Nadia Brashear, a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University specializing in memory and judgment. She and her team published a 2017 study in psychology and aging on magical thinking in adults. They found that older adults, whose average age was about 70, were less superstitious than young adults, averaging about 19 years old. The key seems to be an accumulation of life experience. My mother never got hurt when I stepped on sidewalk cracks. I own a black cat that has never, as far as I know, caused problems. Although I used to fly in airplanes with a lucky teddy bear, the one time I forgot him, the plane didn't crash. Once older adults have accumulated some evidence that those beliefs don't work, they kind of update their beliefs about cause and effect, says Brashear. You may be very well practiced at completely ignoring black cats, Risen tells me. But to kick harder superstitious habits, I should break the reinforcing cycle. Instead of knocking on wood, noticing the positive results and concluding that I should do it again next time, I should dare not to knock on wood. Assuming that it goes okay, you have to remember and note that experience, she says. Then the next time, it will be a little bit easier because you'll realize, oh wait, things went fine last time. By keeping track of these outcomes over time, I can build up data that my lower side of thinking can grasp and that my slower side of thinking can grasp and use to shake my superstitious beliefs, Risen says. So a couple of days ago when my son stayed out late, I held back my hands. I avoided wood. I even managed to sleep. And guess what? He came home just fine. This winter, I'll try it with my roof. And now a cover story, Your Daily Dose of Quantum, How the Science of the Super Small Lets You Smell, See, Touch, and More. If Max Planck hadn't ignored some bad advice, he would never have started a revolution. The pivotal moment happened in 1878, when young Planck asked one of his professors whether to continue pursuing a career in physics. Herr Professor Philipp von Joly told Planck to find another line of work. All the important discoveries in physics had already been made, the professor assured his young protege. As Planck later recalled, von Joly told him, physics may yet keep going on in one corner or another, scrutinizing or putting in order a jot here and a tittle there, but the system as a whole is secured, and theoretical physics is notably approaching its completion. Putting one of those jots in order, it turned out, eventually won Planck a Nobel Prize, and led to the birth of quantum mechanics. The troublesome trifle concerned a very ordinary phenomenon. Why do objects glow the way they do when heated? All materials, no matter what they're made of, behave the same way with increasing temperature, turning red, then yellow, than white. Yet no physicist in the 19th century could explain the seemingly simple process. The problem came to be called the ultraviolet catastrophe, because the best theorem of the day predicted that objects heated to very high temperatures should spew infinite amounts of short wavelength energy. Since we know a strong current doesn't turn light bulbs and toasters into energy-spewing death rays, 19th century physics clearly wasn't the last word. Planck found an answer in 1900 with what amounted to a modern-day hack. He proposed, guessed really, that energy could only be absorbed or emitted in discrete packets, or quanta. It was a radical departure from so-called classical physics, which held that energy flowed in smooth, continuous streams. At the time, Planck had no theoretical justification, but it turned out to work anyway. His quanta effectively capped the amount of energy that heated objects could release at any temperature. No more death rays. So began the quantum revolution. It would take decades of incandescent theoretical work by Albert Einstein, Werner Heisenberg, Niels Bohr, and other titans to transform Planck's inspiration into a full theory. But it all started because no one understood what happens to things when they get hot. The resulting theory, quantum mechanics, deals with particles and blips of energy in the realm of the ultra-small, divorced from our everyday experience, and all but invisible to our clumsy mammalian sensory apparatuses. Well, not completely invisible. Some quantum effects are hiding in plain sight, blatantly and beautifully obvious, like the sun's rays and the twinkling of the stars, something else that couldn't be fully explained before the advent of quantum mechanics. How much of the quantum world can we experience in our daily lives? And what sort of information can our senses glean about the true nature of reality? After all, as the origin of the theory itself makes clear, quantum phenomena can lie just under our noses. In fact, they may be taking place right inside our noses. What's going on in your nose when you wake up and smell the coffee or the slice of bread browning in your non-lethal toaster? For such an in-your-face sensory organ, the nose is poorly understood. No less a luminary than Enrico Fermi, who built the world's first nuclear reactor, once remarked to a friend while frying onions that it would be nice to understand how our sense of smell works. So you're lying in bed and someone has thoughtfully brewed some freshly ground Sumatran dark roast. Molecules from the elixir waft through the air. Your inhalations draw some of these molecules into a cavity between your eyes, just above the roof of your mouth. The molecules stick to a layer of mucus on the upper surface of the cavity, embedded with olfactory neurons. Dangling from the brain like the tentacles of a jellyfish, olfactory neurons are the only part of the central nervous system constantly exposed to the outside world. What happens next isn't quite clear. We know the molecules bind to some of the 400 different receptors on the surface of the olfactory neurons. We don't know exactly how that contact creates our sense of smell. Why is smell such a difficult sense to understand? In part, it's the difficulty of setting up experiments to probe what's going on inside the olfactory receptors of the nose, says Andrew Horsfield, a material scientist at Imperial College London. The conventional explanation for how smell works seems straightforward. The receptors accept very specific shapes of molecules. They're like locks, which can be opened only by the right keys. Each of the molecules escaping from your cup of Joe, according to this model, fits into a particular set of receptors in your nose. The brain interprets the unique combination of receptors activated by their bound molecules as the smell of coffee. In other words, we smell the shapes of molecules. But there's a fundamental problem with the lock and key model. You can have molecules of wildly different shape and composition, which all give you the same odor perception, says Horsfield. It seems that something more than shape must be involved, but what? A controversial alternative to the lock and key model suggests our sense of smell arises not just from the shape of molecules, but also from the manner in which those molecules vibrate. All molecules constantly jiggle with distinct tempos based on their structure. Could our noses somehow detect differences in those vibrational frequencies? Luca Turin, a biophysicist at the Alexander Fleming Biomedical Sciences Research Center in Greece, believes they can. Turin, who also happens to be one of the world's leading perfume experts, was inspired by a vibrational theory of smell first proposed by a chemist Malcolm Dyson in 1938. After Turin first caught scent of Dyson's idea in the 1990s, he started looking for molecules that would allow him to test the theory. He hit upon sulfur compounds, which have a unique odor and a characteristic molecular vibration. Turin then needed to identify a completely unrelated compound, one with a different molecular shape than sulfur, but possessing the same vibrational frequency, to see if it would smell anything like sulfur. Eventually he found one, a molecule containing boron. And sure enough, it reeked of sulfur. That's when the penny dropped, he says. I thought, this can't be a coincidence. Since that odoriferous eureka moment, Turin has been gathering experimental evidence to support the idea, collaborating with Horsfield to work out the theoretical details. 5 years ago, when Turin and colleagues designed an experiment in which some of the hydrogen molecules in a musk-scented fragrance were replaced with deuterium, a variety of hydrogen containing an extra neutron, they found that people could smell the difference. Since hydrogen and deuterium have identical shapes but different vibrational frequencies, the results again suggested that our noses could indeed detect vibrations. Similar experiments with fruit flies complemented those results. Turin's idea remains contentious. His experimental data have divided the interdisciplinary community of olfactory researchers. But if he's right and we do smell vibrations in addition to shapes, how do our noses manage the feet? Turin speculates that a quantum effect called tunneling might be involved. In quantum mechanics, electrons and other particles possess a dual nature, which is both a particle and a wave. This sometimes allows electrons to spread out and travel or tunnel through materials in ways that would be forbidden to particles under the rules of classical physics. The molecular vibrations of a scent molecule might provide the right jump down in energy that electrons need to tunnel from one part of an odor receptor to another. The tunneling rate would change with different molecules, triggering nerve impulses that create the perceptions of different smells in the brain. Tucked away in our noses, then, might be a sophisticated electronic detector. How could our noses have evolved to take advantage of such quantum strangeness? I think we underestimate the technology, so to speak, of life by a couple of orders of magnitude, says Turin. 4 billion years of R&D with unlimited funding is a long time. I don't think this is the most amazing thing that life does. Okay, so you're quaffing your coffee, nearly awake. Your eyelids are gearing up for daytime mode, blinking, letting in a bit of light that's streaming through the window. As you sip your brew, ponder this. The particles of light swarming your face and entering your eyes originated 1 million years ago in the center of the sun, around the time our not-quite-human ancestors started to use fire. The sun wouldn't even be sending out those particles, named photons, if not for the same phenomenon that might underlie our sense of smell, quantum tunneling. Some 93 million miles separate from the sun and Earth, and it takes photons just over 8 minutes to cover that distance. But the bulk of their journey occurs inside the sun, where a typical photon spends a million years trying to escape. Matter is so tightly packed at the center of our star, the hydrogen there is about 13 times denser than lead, that photons can travel only an infinitesimal fraction of a second before being absorbed by a hydrogen ion, which then spits the photon out for another soon-to-be-interrupted journey, ad infinitum. After about a billion trillion such interactions, a photon finally emerges from the surface of the sun, having zigged and zagged randomly for 1,000 millennia. But the photons never would have been born, and the sun wouldn't shine, were it not for quantum tunneling. The sun and all other stars generate light by nuclear fusion, smashing hydrogen ions together to form helium, a process that releases energy. Every second, the sun converts about 4 million tons of matter into energy. But hydrogen ions, single protons, have positive electric charges and naturally repel each other. How can they possibly fuse? With quantum tunneling, the wave nature of protons allows them to overlap ever so slightly, like ripples merging on the surface of a pond. That overlap brings the proton waves close enough so that another force, the strong nuclear force, which kicks in only at extremely small distances, can overcome the particle's electrical repulsion. The protons fuse and release a single photon. Our eyes have evolved to be exquisitely sensitive to these photons. Some recent experiments have shown that we even detect single protons, which raises an intriguing possibility. Could humans be used to test some of the weird features of quantum mechanics? That is, could a person, like a photon or an electron or Schrodinger's hapless cat, dead and alive at the same time, directly engage with the quantum world? What might such an experience be like? We don't know because no one has tried it, says Rebecca Holmes, a physicist at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. 3 years ago, when she was a graduate student at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, Holmes was part of a team led by Paul Quaite that showed people could detect short bursts of light consisting of just three protons. In 2016, a competing group of researchers led by physicist Ali Pasha Vaziri at Rockefeller University in New York found that humans can indeed see single photons. Seeing, though, might not accurately describe the experience. Vaziri, who tried out the photon glimpsing herself, told the journal Nature, "It's not like seeing light. It's almost a feeling at the threshold of imagination." In the near future, Holmes and Vaziri expect experiments that will test what people perceive when photons are put into strange quantum states. For example, physicists can coax a single photon into what they call a superposition, where it exists in two different places simultaneously. Holmes and her colleagues have proposed an experiment involving two scenarios to test whether people might directly perceive a superposition of photons. In the first ho-hum scenario, a single photon would go into either the left or right side of a person's retina, and the person would note on which side of the retina they sense the photon. But in the other scenario, a photon would be placed in a quantum superposition that would allow it to do the seemingly impossible, travel to both the right and left sides of the retina simultaneously. Would the person then sense light on both sides of the retina, or would the interaction of the photon with the eye cause the superposition to collapse, as scientists say, into one position or the other? And if so, would it happen equally on the right and left side, as theory suggests? Based on standard quantum mechanics, the photon in the superposition probably wouldn't look any different to them than actually randomly sending a photon to the left or right, says Holmes. If it turns out that someone participating in the experiment did indeed perceive the photon in both places simultaneously, would that mean the person herself was in a quantum state? You could say the observer was in a quantum superposition for some vanishingly small amount of time, says Holmes. But no one has tried to do this, so truly, we don't know. That's reason enough to do the experiment. Now back to that cup of coffee. The cup feels substantial, a solid chunk of matter firmly in contact with the skin of your hand. But that's an illusion. We never really touch anything, at least not in the sense of two solid slabs of matter coming together. More than 99.99999% of an atom consists of empty space, with nearly all of its stuff concentrated in the nucleus. When you exert pressure against the cup with your hand, the seeming solidity comes from the resistance of electrons in the cup. Electrons themselves don't have any volume at all. They're just fleeting zero-dimensional flecks of negative electric charge that surround atoms and molecules like clouds. And the laws of quantum mechanics limit them to specific energy levels around atoms and molecules. As your hand grasps the cup, it forces electrons from one level to another, and that requires energy from the hand's muscles, which the brain interprets as touching something solid. Our sense of touch, then, arises from an exceedingly complex interaction between electrons around the molecules of our bodies and those of the objects we encounter. From that information, our brain creates the illusion that we possess solid bodies moving through a world filled with other solid objects. Touch doesn't give us an accurate sense of reality, and it may be that none of our perceptions match what's really out there. Donald Hoffman, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of California, Irvine, believes that our senses and brain evolved to hide the true nature of reality, not reveal it. My idea is that reality, whatever it is too complicated and would take us too much time and energy to process, he says. Hoffman likens the picture our brain constructs of the world to the graphical interference on a computer screen. All of the colorful icons on the screen, the trash can, the mouse pointer, the file folders, bear no resemblance at all to what's really going on inside the computer. They're abstractions, simplifications that allow us to interact with complex electronics. In Hoffman's view, evolution has shaped our brains to operate in the same way, as a graphical interface that doesn't reproduce the world with any sort of fidelity. Evolution doesn't favor the development of accurate perceptions. It rewards ones that enhance survival. Or as Hoffman puts it, fitness beats truth. Hoffman and his graduate students have run hundreds of thousands of computer models in recent years to test his ideas. In the simulations, artificial life forms compete for limited resources. And in every case, the organisms programmed to emphasize fitness outcompete the various ones primed for accurate perceptions. For example, if one organism is tuned to accurately perceive, say, the total amount of water present in an environment, it will lose out to an organism that's tuned to perceive something simpler, the optimal amount of water needed to stay alive. So while one organism might construct a more accurate representation of reality, that representation doesn't enhance its survivability. Hoffman's studies have led him to a remarkable conclusion. To the extent that we're tuned to fitness, we may not be tuned to reality. You can't do both. His ideas align with what some physicists believe to be a central message of quantum theory. Reality is not completely objective. We cannot separate ourselves from the world we observe. Hoffman fully embraces that view. Space is just a data structure, he says, and physical objects are themselves also data structures that we create on the fly. When I look at that hill over there, I create that data structure. Then I look away and I've trashed that data structure because I don't need it anymore. As Hoffman's work shows, we haven't yet come to grips with the full meaning of quantum theory and what it says about the nature of reality. Planck himself struggled for most of his life to understand the theory he helped launch, and always believed in an objective universe that exists independently of us. He once wrote about why he decided to go into physics against the advice of his mentor. The outside world is something independent from man, something absolute, and the quest for the laws which apply to this absolute appeared to me as the most sublime scientific pursuit in life. Maybe it will take another century and another revolution to prove whether he was right or as mistaken as Professor Jolly. Run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time, if you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.